You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
It is Monday, January 11th, and this is Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, and what a pretty morning it is. Cold, but beautiful.
After a truly spectacularly tumultuous week, it's nice to be able to settle down and talk about some things this morning. Our second guest actually is going to be talking to us about the markets and what's going on there. But first, we're going to talk to Skip Miller, the author of Outbounding, Win New Customers with Outbound Sales and End Your Dependence on Inbound Leads. Our second guest will be Jason Ware. He's the partner and chief investment officer for the Albion Financial Group. He's going to talk to us about the 2020 stock market returns and the outlook for 2021. One of the things that was really strange about last week was that both Wednesday's market session after the Tuesday night Senate wins and Thursday's market session after the disruption at the Capitol, the market went up, which makes no sense to me, and I'll be asking Jason to explain it. Who's our third guest, Doug?
And our third guest is Ginger Wicks with the Park City Restaurant Association. Is going to join us this morning to review how the holiday season was for the local restaurants and to highlight unique ways local establishments are providing safe experiences for guests. All this and more on Mountain Money this morning. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our guest this morning is Skip Miller. He is the author of Outbounding, Win New Customers with Outbound Sales, and End Your Dependence on Inbound Sales Leads. And many sales organizations, according to Skip, have fallen into an over-reliance on their inbound sales. And his book talks about the skills and the knowledge that you need to generate your own outbound sales leads. Good morning, Skip. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here, guys.
So let's start with a real simple question, and that is, what are inbound leads and what are outbound leads, and how are the teams, how are the skill sets different to succeed with both of those?
And great first question. The purpose of sales, right, is to bring revenue into the company. And years ago, you used to knock on doors or, constantly have to go out and make cold calls and stuff. And about 15 years ago or so, with the internet and technology, marketing was able to generate interest over the internet and give you a link to sign up to, come to my website or please download this white paper. So this whole inbound lead thing came to notion. So pretty soon companies were getting hundreds and thousands of these inbound door knocks, and a salesperson, all they had to do was follow up saying, hi, you came to my website, can I help you? Well, a lot of them are drying up right now, so people have got to sit back and go, the amount of inbound leads coming in, I'm not getting enough, so I'm going to have to do something to generate leads on my own, and they need to go outbound. So the biggest difference from a customer standpoint is interest. So if there's an inbound lead, I mean, there's some initial interest. I mean, they hit your website or requested a white paper for a reason. Outbound, they don't know. I mean, they don't know that they need anything or they need to change. So you have to generate that. So it's two different motions all within the sales umbrella, but they're very different.
I want to talk more about sort of the nature of the difference in sales in those two concepts. But first, I wanted to ask you about why it is you think that these inbound sales numbers are, as you say, drying up. Why is that happening?
Not that it's really a perfect storm or anything, but number one, early adopters, low-hanging fruit, whatever you want to call it, are pretty much gone. So the pick of the litter, now they've got to start getting higher in the organization, or they've got to start going after different leads. So let's take a B2B sale where you're doing business-to-business selling. Pretty soon you're going to get Facebook leads. Well, not too many businesses really are doing a lot of Facebook stuff. So marketing starts generating more and more non-qualified leads. So the volume stays there, but the quality goes down. So you're getting, low-hanging fruit gone, quality starting to dry up, and companies aren't changing rapidly enough to generate more inbound stuff. And then on top of that, you've got the whole COVID thing. So there's just a lot of functionalities right now, and COVID was just kind of like the turbo boost on top of everything.
One of the interesting things I found in the book was your discussion about the difference in the stages of decision-making. with respect to an inbound versus an outbound customer. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on within the companies and how that affects the approach?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let's just look at it from the customer's chair for a second. Customer has a problem, and they figure out what they're doing now. It's not going to solve it, so they got to do something different. They have to change, and people hate to change. So they go, okay, guys, if we're going to make a change, what's the outcome we want? Okay, we're going to generate 20% more material because our demand's up and our machines aren't doing that now. So we're going to have to buy some new machines and get rid of the old ones and maybe hire a supervisor because we're going to be adding headcount. So they figure out what change they've got to make and then what the outcome is for that change and how much money it's going to make them, how much money it's going to cost. Then they sit back and go, okay, let's go talk to some vendors who can sell us some machines or sell us these things that we need. So they've already gotten down that decision process about they have to make a change and they know what they want to do. In an outbound lead, you're calling on somebody going, hi, you know, this is what we do. You think you want to use it? Who knows where they're at in that whole, do they know they've got a problem? Do they know they have to make a change? Do they know what the outcome they want for that change is? So there's a whole different earlier, we call it stage zero. That whole stage zero thing before that buyer goes to stage one, which says, okay, I've got a problem, but you know, I've got some interest now. You know, the lease on my car is running up in a week. So in a week, I won't have a car. Ooh, I better do something. So all of a sudden in the inbounds, they know they've got issues and challenges and outcomes they want. Outbound, you don't know where they're at that continuum. They could be, you know, making a decision tomorrow for vendor B and you're knocking on their door. They're in stage four, you're in stage zero, and you know, you're too late. So that whole decision process, number one, we have a problem. We know that we have to make a change. What's the outcome we want for the change? What's the benefit we're going to get from it? Let's pick vendors, test them out, make a decision, go. That's probably the buy process. And inbound, you're about halfway through. Outbound, you could be anywhere. And that's always the challenge.
Well, so you talk about starting at stage zero, which is a challenge, but actually you're starting at stage sub-zero because you have to cut through the noise to get the conversation going. And I know personally from my professional life, I'm just inundated by very clever email messages and people trying to get a hold of me by phone, and there's people on our team that do a good job of filtering those out. So how does an outbound salesperson get his message out and begin the relationship?
Yeah, and it's, you know, just look at human nature, right? Number one, make sure you talk about them, which is their favorite topic. And you could talk about them regarding an article or something you read about them, their industry they're in, their job title, their profession. Make the big thing we kind of stress, guys, is make me curious. If I'm curious, right, I'm going to really get into it and make me curious about things I want to be curious about, which would be about me, my title, my company, my job, my profession. What's really cool, especially some of the good outbound salespeople, is they basically try to ask great questions, questions that I want to answer. Questions turn on something in our brain called instinctive elaboration. When asked a question, you want to answer it. And there starts the potential of building rapport. So that's always a good thing to start doing is ask questions, be curious, make me curious, and really understand that I don't want to buy your stuff yet. So don't sit back and say, I'm here to help. You don't even know what that, I don't even know that I need help. So try to make sure you understand step one is I have to have a problem. And step two is I have to sit back and say I have to make a change. That's where you probably want to have a chat with somebody, not here's our stuff. We have great stuff. Do you think you could use our stuff, which would be all about you, which is really not a good way to start a good conversation.
So how do you go about getting the information to even start the conversation? In other words, how important is it for you to understand the nature of the potential outbound client's business so that you can at least have a vehicle to start that kind of a conversation?
You know, let's take, in my company, we talk to a lot of VPs of sales. What do VPs of sales in January of a fiscal year, you know, worry about? How can I increase sales? How can I get bigger sale dollar volume? How can I get more leads? How can I fill my funnel and pipeline? How can I? So those are questions VPs of sales and VPs of marketing are asking themselves all the time, especially in January. What about CFOs? As you look at your annual forecast, you know, do you think you have risk there? If you've got risk, especially in the higher dollar buyer sales, maybe we should chat. So you could read annual reports. Type in what keeps a CFO awake at night in 2021. I mean, you'd be shocked at how much information there is out there regarding people's companies or titles. I love, of course, in the B2B world, I love LinkedIn. And for example, I was born and raised in Ohio. So anytime I see a prospect that's from Michigan, which is a natural rival to Ohio, I make fun of that. Hi, John. Skip Miller here from M3 Learning. I understand that you're from that school up north, and which I can't say, but would love to talk. Everybody starts, it brings humor into it. It starts fun. And you can do that just at a little bit of homework. But there's easy ways to access. Don't overthink it. There's easy ways to access about my company, about my title, about my geographical location. It's easy if you're really in the mindset of creating curiosity.
Skip, your book talks about the big five. We've touched on a few of those. If you want to briefly share with our audience what the big five are, and then maybe talk about number four, which is numbers and list, and why that's important.
Sure. We sit back and say, guys, there's typically, you know, a lot of ways to get people's interest. And we come up with what we call the big five. Number one, without a doubt, referrals. If I know John and you know John, you're going to talk to me. Or if I know somebody, you know, at a company, you know, I've got a bunch of people at Google that you probably know. Or referrals by far is the best way to start a relationship and start a discussion. Number two, curiosity. We've already touched on that. Make me curious. It invokes somebody. People always want what they can't have. People always want to know something they don't know. So make me curious is always a good one. Number three, make it about them. Guys, if I see one more email, hi, my name is, what I do, what my company does, that's an instant delete. Emails are great for prospecting, should be no bigger than 120 words, and should be written with your mobile device, because 80% of emails are read on mobile devices. So write it on the device that you want the other person to read. This way you won't write a novel, you'll write it very format-oriented to that mobile device. Numbers and lists are important. Our brains are naturally triggered to look for those things. And digits, the number three, not the word spelled out three. That's why top 10 lists and top 5 lists are always very important and very read a lot, because our brains are naturally drawn to those digits, and it kind of ensures a quick and easy read. And finally, time traveling. There's three dimensions of time, past, present, and future. Go back in time, go forward in time, just don't sit what we call in the two-dimensional world. Hi, John, what's your biggest challenge right now? I mean, boy, that's kind of a nice slice. John, as you look at the next 6 months, as you look at the last 3 6 months, by time traveling, it's almost like you're playing three-dimensional chess. And now you've got a lot more broader area for that prospect to start talking about, than rather than a two-dimensional pointed question. Hi, John, what's your problem? Get you off the phone right now. That's my problem. So as you look at the next 6 months, what are some biggest challenges? That's a better question than, John, right now, what's your biggest challenge? So it's different.
You know, we talk on this program from time to time about differences in financial areas between generations, and particularly how millennials and Gen Z people react differently and treat financial issues differently. What have been your observations about the way in which millennials and Gen Z approach sales, both on the selling side and the buying side?
On the buying side, there are multiple information inputs. You know, we used to go and listen to one input. We used to go buy something, go down to the store and listen to the salesperson make a decision. You know, the millennials and especially the Gen Zs are really into reviews, I want to buy a new set of headphones. I'm going to get on Amazon. I'm going to get on Google. I'm going to get a whole bunch of reviews. I'm going to tweet out to my friends, hey, guys, I need a set of headphones. What's the best thing you got? So they're going to get multiple data points. So from a purchase standpoint, you know, that authority, that credibility is going to be really important. from a selling standpoint, right? That's a buy selling standpoint. Mm-hmm. From a selling standpoint, Gen Z only knows really quick. So they don't know big structures and big, you know, 6-month sales cycles and stuff. They're very, you know, instantaneous. They get 30 leads a day, call the leads, I'm done. You know, they didn't have to do a lot of outbounding homework and stuff and so on. So what we see, and we see a lot of it because I'm in Silicon Valley and there's tons of startups out here hiring, you know, people right out of school. We see that need for instant gratification, having to be put in the pocket and really have these people, let's say, you know, let's go walk through a buy sales process. So from a buy standpoint, Gen Zs are just really, you know, multiple data points. And the more you can help me with that multiple data point and frame a reference, that's great. Outbound, they need to slow down before they can speed up.
And let's talk about once you generate the curiosity, you've got a section in your book that talks about whether links to different podcasts, links to white paper work. What's the best way if you have a piece that you want to pique somebody's curiosity towards to get them to actually read that piece?
So there's two things, right? What's the value of free? Nothing. So if I just sit back and say, hey, here's a link, you know, that doesn't do anything for me. I mean, yeah, anybody can give me that stuff. There's no value to it. So one is get. John, if you really are interested, let me know and I'll send you this link. Get their curiosity when they come back and say, okay, what link? And that's very helpful. Another way is to tailor it. Hey, John, heard this podcast, you know, it'd be attached, especially at the 4-minute, 27-second mark. There's a great 2 minutes that probably is going to be interesting for you. 4-minute, 27-second mark? What are you talking about? I mean, all of a sudden, I don't have to listen to the whole 30 minutes. I could actually attack just a little snippet that somebody says is important to me. So by tailoring or by offering a give-get is a great way to generate curiosity and really show that I've done some homework and, you know, you might be interested because I've done some homework on your company. I've done some homework on this podcast and I think there's a match, you know, so respect that I've done some homework for you and I've tailored for you. It's a quick and easy read. So, or quick and easy listen. So my son just sent me a podcast the other day and said, Dad, it's a 20-minute podcast, but at the 4-minute mark, this is really good. Okay. I went right to the, I mean, people almost pretty much do as they're told to do. And I did. So it was kind of, you know, proof pudding there.
You talk in the book about different levels of approach in outbound marketing. In other words, different levels within the target company's hierarchy. Talk to a little bit about how those different levels need to be approached differently.
What do you mean? Can you clarify a little bit?
Sure. You talk about whether I'm going to approach someone at a sales level, at a senior level, at a C-suite level. How are those approaches different?
So if you think about it, right, companies pretty much are broken into two camps, people who use what you sell and people who are responsible for the physical nature of the business. And sometimes they blend together and sometimes they don't. I'm on a mission to destroy the term decision maker because I think there's two. There's one that we call below the line and one we call above the line, and they're different. Below the line says, I'm going to buy something because I'm the one who's going to use it. I'm the one who's going to be responsible for it. I want to make it the best, easiest, most powerful. You know, I'm going to have to test it out because people are going to look at me saying, you're responsible to make it work. The above the line buyer says, I got a $20 million shortfall, and I'm going to need a couple things to make up that shortfall. So if I buy these things, I can see where it's going to make a big dent in my $20 million problem. I really don't care if it's vendor A, vendor B, vendor C, or the other. As long as it makes a dent in my $20 million problem. And the above the line and below the line buyer are so different. The analogy, guys, we use is family. I've got a big family, 5 brothers, sisters. Before COVID, when we got together, we got 50, 60 people. There's a lot of people. There were so many people. We have 2 different tables. We have the kid table and the adult table. And the kids loved it because they got to speak kid talk below the line. The adults love it because they didn't have to speak kid talk. They could speak like adults, which is above the line. And, boy, it's very different. What we find is salespeople are really good selling it below the line. Teachers and benefits and demos and trials and presentations, that's what they're taught to do. So when they get a chance to go to the C-suite, the above-the-line buyer, they take their Kid Talk and make an executive presentation of the Kid Talk and go to the above-the-line buyer. And the above-the-line buyer goes, that's Kid Talk. I really don't care. And I remember years ago in my office, we had to buy a printer. And the salesperson actually asked me if I wanted to see a demo of the printer. I looked at him. I said, I bet you it prints. Now, my office admin, she was really interested in it because she's going to have to change the cartridges. She's the one who wants, you know, the 30 pages a minute with the 500-page drawer. I mean, she's the one who's going to use it. So that was important to her. To me, I just wanted, you know, the best value and lower my cost per workbook by 20%. That's what I wanted.
So,
as long as it met my decision criteria, that's all I cared about.
So what that speaks to really is for a salesperson to be successful, they have to be willing to take feedback and incorporate that feedback. And some people are good at that, some people are not. What's your experience? Are salespeople overall good at taking feedback? And Skip, I want you to start with your quick story about your first book and the feedback you got from your editor. Because when I read that, I was like, ooh, that would have been tough feedback to get after writing the first two or three chapters of my first book.
Yeah, and feedback is always in the eye of the beholder, right? It's a learning trait to really make sure you learn. You know, I'll stand in front of a group of sales managers, and I'll say, how many people in this room will say that you learn more from your losses than your victories? Everybody raise their hand. And then I'll ask the managers, what are you doing to help your salespeople lose that? Because that's where they're supposed to learn the most, right? Well, when I wrote my first book, spent months doing it and stuff, it was pretty good. Rewrote it again, made sure it was great, sent it to the publisher. Within the first week or two, I get a note back saying, Skip, great book, but you said, I think and I believe like 30 times. I go, well, I do think that. I go, that's what I think, it's what I believe. They go, Skip, you're writing a book like you speak. You're not writing a book like people read. When you say, I think, I believe, your passion's coming out. When readers read, I think, I believe, they go, what an arrogant idiot. It's all about him. Get rid of it. I go, no, it's what I think. No, get rid of it. Stop writing as you speak. Write how people read. And boy, that had such an impact on me. Even today, I'll write an email, and I'll go through it, and I'll see what I mentioned I three or four times. And I have to go through it and get rid of those because that's not what people want to read. You got to start writing how people read as opposed to writing how people think. And it was big feedback for me. Did I take it well? Yeah, you know what? I probably sat there and said, you guys don't know anything about sales for a couple of days. And then I finally realized that, you know, that was wrong. And I had a change to what I needed to do. So feedback is always kind of a tough thing to take, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a good note for us to end on, which is, you know, in order for us to improve, we have to be receptive to feedback. And Skip, your book gives us a great deal of stuff to think about and give feedback to ourselves on. We've been speaking with Skip Miller. He is the author of the book Outbounding, Win New Customers with Outbound Sales and End Your Dependence on Inbound Sales. Skip, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Money, and we'll be back in a minute. Please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Next up, we have one of my favorite guests, Jason Ware of Albion Financial, where he is the partner and chief investment officer. I have a lot of questions for Jason about where things are going in general, but first I have a specific. Last week was, in my mind, one of the most extraordinary weeks in recent American history. We had a change in Senate control on Tuesday, we had a riot at the Capitol on Wednesday, and we had an unbelievably awful jobs report on Friday. And yet, the market didn't go down significantly. What's up with that, Jason?
Good morning. You know, that's always the question when markets go up or down is what's causing the action in the stock market. And as you noted, last week was certainly a week that was, you know, not without its events. And I think what we saw last Wednesday in particular had a lot of folks unsettled. I think the way that we think about the reason the market kind of worked right through that is at the end of the day, while what we saw on our TV screens and what we read about in the newspapers was certainly unsettling and, you know, problematic on a whole host of different levels, as it relates to the trajectory of the economy over the next 3, 6, and 12 months, as it relates to the path for corporate earnings over the next 6 to 12 months, the problems in Washington, D.C., speak little to those things being upended. And that's really, at the end of the day, what the stock market cares most about. It can be this almost alien type, you know, body, if you will, where it can, you know, shrug off a lot of these human stories and a lot of these, you know, nasty headlines, and just look through those things and say, okay, but does this impact the economy? Does this impact, you know, the earnings that Amazon's going to make next quarter? And does this change the trajectory of the Federal Reserve in keeping interest rates low and supporting the economy and the market? So I think that was really the takeaway from what we saw in Washington. And as it relates to, you know, the jobs report, that's definitely more front and center in terms of, you know, what's going on in the economy. But I think there, you know, it was one report. We had a string of several encouraging jobs reports prior to that, in the 7 months prior to that, where we saw lots of job gains, and we've been coming back from the recession last spring. And I think that investors are kind of looking through the near-term softness in the economy and saying, you know what, if we have pandemic-ending vaccines, which we do from Pfizer and Moderna, and we're probably going to get one from Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca here soon, then, you know, we see light at the end of the tunnel, and, you know, over the next few months, the economy should restore to some semblance of normal soon. So, you know, we're not going to be too concerned about what we saw with the jobs report on Friday as a result.
You know, Jason, your answer, I can't help but observe that your answer somewhat reminds me of one of the favorite answers I once heard in a deposition when I was defending a senior executive in an insider trading case. And he was asked, "Mr. So-and-so, why did the stock go down on Tuesday?" And his response was, "I believe there were more sellers than buyers." But, you know, more directly, I want to focus for a minute on the Senate shift. To what extent do you think the market perceives that the Democratic control of the Senate means it's more likely we'll have more stimulus, which in turn I would assume would be perceived by the market as positive?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that theory. You know, as I look at what happened last week, I think that was clearly the overarching positive of the list of events that were listed. So, yeah, I think, you know, a 50-50 Senate outcome with Vice President Harris, you know, with the tying vote, and Joe Biden clearly wanting to, you know, bring forth more stimulus as we're working through this pandemic and the troubled economy as a result is clearly a good thing. I think that's definitely in part what we saw last week with regards to the market going higher, was this idea that if we do get more stimulus, maybe we get some $2,000 checks here in the next few weeks. Maybe we get more PPP money or some direct assistance to those who are unemployed that will extend further beyond what we've already been given. I think those are all, you know, pro-growth and pro-cyclical policies, and I think the market certainly celebrates that. So yeah, I think you're correct. I think that was certainly part of the positive news last week. It was a bit overshadowed to some degree by what we saw on Wednesday and then the jobs report Friday. But again, I think investors are savvy enough to look through the next few weeks and focus on the next 6 to 12 months. And that's what stocks do. They discount the future. It's not what's happening right now that matters so much. It's what's likely to happen over the next, you know, few quarters. And I think that's what the market's reflecting.
Jason, those are good points. And as we look at the market going forward, we've had you on as a guest, as Roger said several times. You've been very gracious with your time with us. We had you on about a year ago, and one of the questions we asked you was, at that time, the market had been up about 30% over the previous 12 months. And the question was, gee, isn't the market overvalued? And I want to ask that question again with the backdrops that since we've had you on last, the market's up almost another 20% by S&P 500. Since then, isn't the market overvalued now? And if not, when is it overvalued?
So it's a great question. And, you know, as we look at valuation, we don't see current levels as problematic. You know, instead, what we observe is that stocks over the past 10 years have returned a little better than 11% per year on a price return basis. And after inflation, it's around 9.2 to 9.3%. Which is only slightly better than the long-run historical returns you get out of the stock market. And meanwhile, these returns have been juxtaposed next to, you know, a generally growing economy, a growing earnings trajectory, interest rates that have been pinned at or near zero. They're actually negative on a real basis when you take inflation out. That's extraordinarily, you know, stimulative to both the economy and the markets. You know, monetary policy regimes around the world have consistently provided accommodative financial conditions for the markets and the economy, and there's a benign inflation picture. So that's a good cocktail for stocks. And unless you think that picture is going to change, and we don't for the foreseeable future, then stocks continue to be the best place to be. And I think that's what we've seen expressed in how investment managers and individual investors are allocating their assets between stocks and bonds. So just because prices go up, and look, we've had a big run since the March lows. We've had a big run since the March lows in 2009 after the great financial crisis. But just because prices go up isn't proof of a bubble. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that as long as interest rates remain low and inflation remains under control, then valuations should be higher on stocks because the competition for those dollars looking at very low bond yields and very low interest rates is just not there. So, you know, it's hard to define a bubble, getting to the second part of your question. You know, everyone has their own kind of methodology. It's less science and a lot more art. You know, I think the last true bubble we saw in stock, U.S. stocks was around 99-2000 when we had the NASDAQ trading at, you know, over 100 times earnings. We had the S&P 500 around 35 times earnings. I believe Coke, Walmart, and Johnson & Johnson were all north of 45, 50 times earnings. And we had interest rates at 6%. The 10-year treasury was 6 to 7% at that time. You know, looking at the market now, you know, we have Google at 27 times earnings. We have Apple at 28 times earnings. And the S&P is around 21. And we have interest rates that, again, on a negative are negative on a real basis. So I'm not smart enough to tell you what a bubble exactly is going to look like in terms of valuation. But I can tell you that when we look at the full picture, stocks seem to be reasonably valued.
The place to be part of your analysis, I certainly get. I mean, there really isn't a great alternative, as you sort of have laid out for us. But let's talk a little bit more about P/E ratios, because again, I remember, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when I was in economics, and I was taught that a stock price should fundamentally reflect the value of what's being earned. And P/E ratios above 20, where does that fit historically? They said I think the S&P is around 21 now. Where does that fit historically?
And let's start with helping our audience know what P/E is first, please.
Sure. So the P/E ratio is the price-to-earnings ratio. You can look at it at the individual stock level. You can look at it at the, you know, S&P 500 level. And it's just simply the price or the index level divided by the earnings of the companies in the index or earnings of the company specific stock you're evaluating. So if you have, you know, if the stock price is $100 and the earnings are going to be 10, then the PE is 10. So it's 100 divided by 10. And that's kind of the simple way to think about it. And why that's important is because it represents the multiple of earnings that investors are willing to pay on what they expect to be a higher future stream of cash flows. So it's a very core fundamental analysis that's done in financial markets to determine valuation on the market or on individual stocks. And to answer, Roger, your question more specifically about, you know, where we fall looking at the arc of history, you know, being around 21 times earnings is higher than the average nominal PE over the last 20 years, 40 years, 50 years. Going back to the 1920s, we are absolutely at a fairly elevated level. It's not the highest it's ever been. As I noted, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was around 35 times on the S&P 500. NASDAQ was over 100 times. So to be at 21 is higher than the long-term average, which is around 16.5 to 17, but it's not nosebleed. And again, I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that, you know, looking at a PE in isolation without taking the broader context of not only economic conditions, but market conditions into account doesn't tell you much. So, you know, to say the market is at 21 times doesn't tell us a lot, because I would need to then ask, well, where are interest rates? What's the economy doing? These are all elements to the equation that will ultimately determine whether or not the market is overvalued. And again, you know, if that historical long run nominal PE is around 16.5 to 17, but also the long run interest rate level is around 6 or 7% as measured by the 10-year treasury bond, then, you know, you can see why that comparison is important. Right now, again, we are just over 1% on the 10-year treasury bond. And when you back out inflation, you actually get a negative return. So 21 times earnings in that environment to us does not seem extended.
And Jason, let's talk about what's happened over the last 12 months and the importance for investors, the average investor, the person listening in on this show. So a year ago, the markets were looking really strong. The economy was looking strong. The U.S. was every quarter showing lower and lower unemployment. The world economy was humming. Things were looking great. And as we've seen, things can change, and they can change quickly and unexpectedly yep. for reasons none of us could have thought about 6 months earlier. And we saw the market do the fastest drop in U.S. history, and then a very strong recovery. And so as we look at that data set, what's the average investor to do? Are they better off coming up with a long-term plan and sticking with that? Or are they better off saying, boy, the market's going down, let's react to that. The market's going up, let's react to this. What do you think the average investor is best served by and why?
It's a great question. In my initial response when asked that is always that, you know, you're ultimately your outcome as it pertains to your retirement and to your experience in the stock market and investing is the following. What's more important is time in the market and not timing the market. And it's not something I've come up with. A lot smarter people standing on the shoulder of giants have said that. And it's one of the most true, I think, perspectives one can take when you're building a portfolio, when you're investing in the stock market. And what that means is that, you know, if you look back over history, in just about every calendar year, you can anticipate a 10% or better correction in the stock market. It happens all the time. And as a result, that means that we are likely to, because we're human beings and we're wired in a certain way, to try to react to those types of that type of volatility in stocks. But what history has shown very clearly and what's been borne out in the data is that those that attempt to make changes to their portfolio based on what the stock market is doing or based on some strategist's expectations for 2021 or Wall Street's views on, you know, interest rates or whatever predictive methodology one chooses to pay attention to, what we found is that usually that ends up not helping investors and it ends up being a disservice to the portfolio over the longer term. So our counsel is you want to get the asset allocation right, that first and foremost. You want to make sure that you have the right composition of stocks and bonds and cash for your financial goals, for your objectives. And then once you figure that out, and that's going to be a function of time horizon. It's going to be a function of your risk profile, your relationship with the stock market, and kind of who you are as an investor. And then, of course, as I mentioned, your goals and objectives. And once you get that dialed in, building a portfolio, especially on the equity side, where you're going to see more of that volatility over time, with high quality companies and really sound investments, it's kind of this next level of defense that we play for our clients and that we think makes a lot of sense for folks that are in the market. Because, you know, if you know what you own and you own high quality companies and high quality investments, you're more likely to weather, you know, drawdowns in the market and volatility in the market. You know, do you want to sell Apple when it's down 25%? When you know the iPhone 5 is coming, I'm sorry, the iPhone 12 with 5G is coming, you have AirPods in your ears, you know, you have the watch on your wrist, and you really feel like you understand that business and you know where that business is going. Most people are unlikely to dump Apple when things get tough, but a company you don't understand and maybe you're not even familiar with what they do, you see that price drop 30, 40, 50%, and you're more apt to make a bad decision at the wrong time. So you want to build that equity side of the portfolio with really strong investments and strong companies. And then you just got to remember that time horizon. You got to, at the end of the day, you got to circle back to why you're invested. You know, last March, as you noted, Doug, when we had that 35% drop in 3 weeks, which was the fastest on record, you know, there's a lot of folks out there without advisors or that don't understand this well enough that are questioning, well, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I shouldn't be in this portfolio. Maybe I shouldn't have bought that ETF. And that kind of sentiment can do a lot of damage to one's portfolio. So it's knowing why you own what you own, keeping in mind that time horizon and those goals, and oftentimes just staying the course is by far and away the best approach for the average investor.
And Jason, I just want to quickly clarify and share with the audience, you and I work next to each other. I'm fortunate to, in non-pandemic times, my desk is next to your desk, and we have these conversations. I want to stress one last thing, and then I know Roger's got one last question for you. But your comment about, you know, the hurt that you can receive by moving in and out of the market, just a quick reminder to folks, you know, since the March lows, the market has recovered. The S&P 500 is up 75%. The NASDAQ has almost doubled since the March lows. And the small caps are up over 100% since the lows. So missing out on that, if you're trying to time the market, does make a difference in your portfolio. And Roger, I'll turn it over to you now.
Last question. Let's talk a little bit about the real economy as opposed to the stock market over the next year and how one might affect the other. We're looking at vaccines, hopefully coming widely available in the next 3 to 4 months. Certainly sectors that have been battered, like entertainment and sports, one would expect to rebound, and perhaps you might see even pent-up demand in vacation and recreation. Talk a little bit about your perspective on what you expect to see in terms of GDP growth and those kinds of sectors of the economy in the second half.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, the data show that in the U.S. and in the world, in fact, you know, we are drowning in money right now. And because of this historic excess liquidity, you know, the argument goes that, you know, rising stock prices and an economic recovery are the inevitable outcomes of that level of unprecedented monetary stimulus and fiscal pump priming. So to give you a sense of the level of liquidity, and this is all important as it relates to the economy in 2021, you know, the level of liquidity that we're talking about here, that's broad money in the U.S., and we look at that, define it as M2, it's up nearly 30%. Since the crisis began in early 2020. And that's a huge amount of money. And for some context, in the 12 months after Lehman collapsed in September of 2008, which was a big and complex crisis, M2 was up around 11% in the 12 months after that. So we've had nearly three times the growth in the money stock over a shorter period of time. Now, in practice, this means that we now have over $1.1 trillion in additional savings in the U.S. economy. We have some $3 to $4 trillion, depending on how you want to measure it, on cash on the sidelines and money market and other near money accounts that could go into the stock market, that could, you know, go into boosting, you know, household spending and aggregate demand. And with more fiscal stimulus likely coming under the new regime in Washington here and a Federal Reserve that is unlikely to change course anytime soon, we think that underpins the economy for 2021. So, of course, overlaying all of that is the fact that, as you mentioned, we have vaccines that are likely to put, by and large, an end to the pandemic sometime this year. So if we have a host of folks coming out of their homes that are reengaging in activities in almost a celebratory manner, I think it's going to have a feeling that's similar to, not that I was there, of course, but, you know, the end of World War II or the end of the last pandemic, the last major pandemic in 1918, which a lot of folks, a lot of historians will tell you set off in some way the Roaring Twenties. This idea that people come out of their homes with a new and fresh optimism and take on life because they spent the better part of the last year or two cooped up in their home. So I think that reemergence into society and that resumption of old economic activity juxtaposed to an enormous amount of liquidity, excess liquidity in the economy in terms of savings rates, in terms of increased income because of the massive stimulus that we had last year and we're likely to get more of this year, because of what the Fed has done in terms of, you know, making sure that the financial markets are awash in liquidity. All of that is likely to hit the economy this year and into 2022, and that probably sets off, all things equal, a fairly strong boom for the economy. I don't think it's out of the question to assume that we may see the best GDP growth rate this year in 2021 that we've seen over the last 30 years as measured by specific calendar years. You know, to get 4 or 5, maybe even 6% real GDP, I think is a possibility. It's one that we, you know, I'd say it's probably better than 50-50 odds that we see something like that, given what I just mentioned. We also have, of course, corporations that are likely to return to historic levels of profitability this year, not only because of the return to revenue growth, given the economy that I just described, but also the cost cutting that happened in 2020 because of the pandemic is unlikely to come back as quickly as revenue, and that's called operating leverage. And that operating leverage means we're going to see more profitable companies this year in the U.S. Than we would have otherwise. And I think all of that together with a Fed that's still supporting the backdrop to us suggests a pretty strong economy this year.
Time spent with Jason Ware is always a good investment. Jason, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be Money. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. On the phone with us now is Ginger Wicks with the Park City Restaurant Association. Ginger, thank you for joining us, and let's jump in. How was the holiday season for our local restaurants and our local businesses here in town?
Well, thanks for having me, and Happy New Year. I would say it's kind of it was probably a mixed bag for everybody. Some of our local restaurants have reported that they had the best numbers they've seen in years, and others have reported that they were unfortunately down a bit. So it is a little bit all over the place. I do think that our unfortunate lack of snow did encourage folks to dine out versus staying on the slopes. And so that probably helped a little bit as well. But it is a little bit all over the board.
Talk to us a
little. From the reports that we've gotten back. So,
Ginger, what have you observed about the differences in the kinds of restaurants that did well versus did poorly?
I would say for sure the ones that have, that I know of that have reported higher numbers, outdoor dining, those folks that were able to expand their outdoor areas and add heaters, definitely saw success and continue to see success with those improvements.
And I know another thing that was likely a boost was before the holiday season, there was a cutoff at which point alcohol could no longer be served. I know that was lifted for the holidays.
Yeah.
And I know the Park City Restaurant Association played a role in that. Talk to us about how that played out and what your role was in helping to make that happen.
Well, we work very closely with the Utah Restaurant Association, the URA, and Melva and her team down there work very closely with the governor and legislators. And our role was simply just trying to support their efforts. As we approached the holidays, several of our restaurants reached out to us saying, you know, this is killing us now. And as we move into the holiday season, is going to really hurt us even more, especially think about trying to offer any sense of a holiday celebration to ring in the new year or whatnot. It was really handcuffing our restaurants for success, especially, of course, our bars. And so we offered any support we could to the URA in their meetings and efforts in working with the governor and legislators to get that curfew lifted. And fortunately, we were able to do that.
During the summer, we saw a number of restaurants sort of reducing hours. Some were cutting out lunches. Talk to us about what's going on now in terms of, particularly given that we're in the height of tourist season. Are most restaurants sort of back to being open full time now?
No, I wouldn't say that. They are still adjusting hours based off of what's happening within their own given operations. They're still facing a lot of challenges. Those that are dealing with outbreaks of COVID within their own establishments. A lot of employees are holding multiple jobs throughout our community and are carpooling. So if you have an outbreak at one location, it can be a bit of a domino effect through our restaurant community because folks, again, are working multiple jobs or are carpooling or living together. And so when those outbreaks or reduced, you know, people are going into quarantine and so they are dealing with reduced staff, they can't cover the hours that they've advertised. So it's an ever-changing challenge for restaurants to keep employees safe, keep patrons safe, and move through the pandemic for all of those reasons.
Well, hopefully we're closer to the end on this pandemic. with the vaccines rolling out. You know, when we talk to people, either restaurant owners or folks from your organization, a common theme is the difficulty of getting employees. How has that changed given the relatively high levels of unemployment in Utah? Are restaurants able to get the employees they need, or is it still a big challenge?
No, I would say it's still a big challenge. In fact, just yesterday, I got a text message from a restaurant owner saying, we need help finding employees. We need the association to help us match up employees to available shifts. And so I'm going to be spending, obviously, the next few days trying to figure out a good way to provide assistance in getting the word out as to what shifts are available to try and support our members, but it is still a very big challenge.
Ginger, before we wrap up, a couple of interesting things have been going on. One is sort of the creation of new creative things like igloos. Talk to us a little bit about what restaurants are doing to facilitate outdoor dining and also about the process that restaurants have to go through to get approval from the county with respect to the layouts they're using.
Well, the igloos that you would find at Butcher's, Wasatch Brew Pub has a version of igloos on their deck, as well as Stein Erickson Lodge. They're hugely successful. I know that some of those igloos, you can't even get a reservation to dine in them. So they're very hugely successful. If you're within the city limits, the Park City Municipal was very good in working with restaurants to get through the permitting processes to put those structures up very quickly and made it as seamless as they could to support the restaurants in these new creative endeavors. The corner store up at Park City Mountain Resort, they added an extensive heater system up there, which has allowed them to expand their outdoor dining and has been very popular, especially with the warm temperatures that we've been experiencing. They're doing very well up there. If you're out in the county, it's a little bit more challenging, I think, for some restaurants to get through the permitting process, but the county is working diligently to just make sure those structures go up safely because, of course, we don't want any accidents to happen.
Yeah, and I've been super impressed with the innovation I've seen in the restaurant industry. And Ginger, we thank you so much for joining us this morning. Ginger Parks with the Park City Restaurant Association.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.